Come right in, pull up a chair. It's time once again to gather around the gaming table with your friends at The Gaming Game. Proudly sponsored by Victory Point Games. This time around, Jeff will be reviewing Emerald Empire from AEG, and Elliot will be tackling Mansions of Madness from Fantasy Flight Games, as well as Resident Evil from Bandai. Scott Nicholson will join us to talk gaming at the library on the latest edition of The Game Plan. We'll have news, views, and more on this episode of The Gaming Game. Now here's your hosts, Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller.
Hi, I'm Jeff McAleer.
And I am Elliot Miller.
Yes, he am, is. Welcome back, and we're about a week behind schedule, but hey, last week it was Mother's Day, we had a lot of things going on, and I've been working on a redesign of our website, but at least we're back.
Welcome back. Oh yeah, I am back.
Yes, you are back. Welcome back.
For some reason, that reminds me that Ashton Kutcher is replacing Martin Sheen on Two and a Half Men.
Yeah, so.
Just throwing that in.
I don't watch the show, so.
Two and a Half Men was actually a very funny show.
Yeah.
Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, Martin Sheen. Martin Sheen is hysterical in that show. Oh, my gosh.
He did make appearances.
He may have. I don't know. So, shall we get on to the news?
Let's get to the news.
Good evening, Mr. Mission Office, South American. All the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to press flash.
For the second consecutive year, the Origins Game Fair has announced that the exhibition hall is sold out. The hall has over 350 booths representing more than 200 companies in the industry. And you want to make sure that you pre-register for the show before May 31st, because you'll save $10 on your full show badge. This year's theme is Victoriana, with steampunk tossed in. Games that fall into the theme of Victoriana for the 2011 Origins Game Fair are going to be featured in the program guide. I'm not real familiar with too many steampunk Victorian age games out there, but I guess there must be enough of them if they're going to be in the program guide. Some of the major supporters of the show, of course, Mayfair Games is a co-sponsor, Rio Grande Games, Troll and Toad, Sandstorm Productions, Elfenworks, Bandai, Adventure Retail, Cryptozoic, Catalyst Game Labs, Looney Labs, Chimera Hobby Shop, Decision Games, Hills Wholesale Gaming, WizKids, Eagle Games, Geek Chic, GPA, Battlefront, Kenzer & Company, Reaper Hobby Q, Z-Man Games, Game Science, and Free RPG Day. Wake up.
Sorry. That's a long list.
Hey, they sold out. They've got 200 companies going to be there.
All in 3 inches of space.
That's booth. Right. In a closet. They'll be in the Villa Park studio.
That's right. Appearing live.
Also, while we're on the topic of Origins, for all of our visitors and listeners who'd like to meet up with us for a bite and a beer, Ellie and I are reserving tables at Barley's Brewing Company on Friday, June 24th. We're going to make the reservation for 9 p.m., but we're going to welcome folks to stop on by throughout the night. I can't say we're going to be closing the bar, but I'm sure we'll hang out for a few hours, so stop on by and say hi. You might find your way onto the show, and we may even have a surprise or two in store. For those who would like to have dinner with us, please email Elliot at Elliot, that's two L's and two T's, miller@thegaminggang.com, and please do so by June 14th so we can have a fairly accurate headcount. Even if you're not hungry, don't let that stop you from coming by. And we're sure you'd like to do some gaming with us, so we'll be posting our schedule for each day of the game fair, and I'm sure we'll be hanging out in the open gaming area as well. We're going to do our best to update our schedule on the website itself, but I'd say our Twitter feed might be a better bet of keeping track of us. And if you can't make it out to Origins this year, keep an eye out for us at Gen Con in August.
Hey,
don't be too excited. Hey!
Wow, we're going to have our schedule planned out in advance, huh?
No, it's not going to be completely planned out, but we should get our press package, which is going to have like a breakdown of different things, so we're going to schedule accordingly.
All right. Sounds good to me.
That's how these things work.
Oh, I see you're an old hand at this.
No, I just know how these things work.
All right, sounds good. I don't know how to.
I've read up on it. Our press package will include a schedule of all the different stuff that's going on. So there.
Coming in the third quarter of 2011 is The Adventurers, The Pyramid of Horus from Fantasy Flight Games. The game features all new characters in another adventure story. So instead of rolling boulders, you have to watch out for falling stone blocks. There's wandering mummies. Hidden for centuries below the shifting Egyptian sands, the Pyramid of Horus sat undisturbed until a research expedition on the limestone plateau of Abu Rawash uncovered...
Didn't the Navy SEALs just waste that guy?
Yes, I believe they did. So, it looks pretty neat. It's got the gimmicks that the original game had that made it all fun and where you get to be killed multiple ways and multiple times.
They're different mummies. Gimmicks.
Yes, different ways. You know, mummies and blocks dropping on your head and things like that. That's coming third quarter 2011.
I know you'll be excited.
Yeah, I am excited.
I know. That's why I meant that. You'll be excited. Hey, you'll actually get to replace some of your lost adventurers figures, too.
Nah, they're new characters.
Yeah, but I know. But at least you'll have some characters you can play with now.
Whee! Now I'm just going to let my daughter have them. It's all I do. They'll be gone.
Listeners out there are like, you fool!
You fool.
I flip out when people put a coffee ring on one of my cards. You give the figures away to your daughter? You fool! And you really like that game, too.
It's fun. I've never won, but it's a lot of fun. Yeah, the boulder's cool, rolling around, chasing after you. You're like, wah!
Is that exactly how you are? You're like, wah! That's what you just said.
Well, you know, I don't scream in horror. I just get a little enticed.
Squeak of horror.
The squeak of horror. Horror has returned, and it has a squeak.
Despite the lack of an exclamation point, Lock and Load Games is jubilant. Brian Train's operational simulation of the German invasion of Poland in 1939 is flying, or at least being carried away in a mail truck, out from their door to your door. The game uses a unique non-random grid matrix coupled with a semi-random determination of casualties to resolve combat. Coupling this with simple yet restrictive supply rules, straightforward weather determination, and other bits and pieces of chrome, you're going to find you'll have a fun yet rich simulation with summer lightning. And beauty? Lock and Load is pretty sure you're going to like Mark von Marschall's work. The counters are colorful, yet simple, the map lush, yet unobtrusive. And Summer Lightning is available now.
Now. So, you know, every once in a while, a game shows up that nobody's ever heard of. And nobody
like Rowboat?
Knows where it exists.
Like yeah. Rowboat?
Right, exactly.
And it's games that people hope and prayed that... would never exist.
Wouldn't
like
exist.
Rowboat.
So I'm at Toys R Us yesterday, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have this big Pirates of the Caribbean section of toys because, you know, the
Wonder
new
why.
Movie's coming out.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Episode 4 of the trilogy of Pirates of the Caribbean.
Wouldn't that be a quadrilogy?
Yes, I was being...
facetious. Yes, I know.
So they have this game there, right? And it's called Master of the Seas, the strategy game.
Master of my own domain?
Master of my own domain. So I pick it up and I'm just looking at it because I'm always on the lookout for games and stuff. And it actually looks kind of interesting.
Hmm.
So I picked it up. Now I haven't played it yet.
Now, did you buy it?
Yeah.
Well, you said you picked it up. I thought maybe you shoplifted it at the door.
Excuse me, sir. What's that big square thing? It's my hump. In Master of the Seas, you're an infamous captain from Disney's Pirates of the Caribbean. Command your ship, sail to different islands, man your ship with new crew, and search for your desired prizes. Throughout the game, prizes change hands as you clash in ship-to-ship battles. If you're the first captain to collect all three of your prizes and return to your home port, you become Master of the Seas and win the game. this game comes with, you can play one of the four captains. You can play Barbarossa, Blackbeard, Davy Jones, or Jack Sparrow, right?
Okay.
And they have these little stand-up ships. Well, they're pretty heavy cardboard that slide into these plastic stands, and these stands hold these little marker tokens. And the board, there's not really a board. You just have an island, which is Port Royal, that goes in the middle and holds all your extra pieces. And then you lay out these six other islands around it. Similar to how Luna Luna looks, you know, where you just lay it out. It's random each time you play.
Luna Luna or just Luna?
Oh, yeah, Luna. It's so good we say it twice.
Lunar Luna? Looney Luna.
So you set these islands apart, and then you have your ship, and it comes with this captain's caliper thing, which is really like a movement. Captain's caliper looks kind of like a compass.
Yeah, I know what a caliper is.
Well, yeah, okay. I think of it as a part of my car. You use that for your movement. So it's almost like a miniatures game, because you roll these dice and you get movement points, and you can increase your movement by collecting these different crew member cards and placing them on your ship. And you're traveling from island to island trying to find the specific prizes that your ship needs in order to win the game.
Like Cupid dolls and stuffed animals?
Exactly. Well, there is the Jack Sparrow voodoo doll that you can
get. There you go.
Or Davy Jones, of course, wants the dead man's chest. And not only that, it's got combat in it, so you can go up to another player and attack him. And if you do enough damage, you can steal some of their stuff. And, you know, I'm looking at it, it says ages 9 plus, and I'm looking at it like, you know, this might actually be fun. So I picked it up, and I haven't played it yet. I've done searches. I can't find it on the internet anywhere. It's not on BoardGameGeek yet. Nobody knows that this game even exists.
Who's it made by?
It is made by this company.
I've heard of them.
Oh, yeah, they are great. It's made by Jack's Pacific Games and Puzzles. Okay, and I went and I looked on their website, and they don't have any information about this game at all. Then I went and looked up it says invented by this other gaming site. And I went and looked on their site, and they don't have anything about the game either. So, folks, Toys R Us. Master of the Seas strategy game.
Now, this isn't something that you've obtained through your bootleg channels to China, is it?
No. Not this time. It was just sitting there, so I'm going to give it a try, and I'll have a review later.
Yes, most definitely. You'll have to keep everyone informed and up to date on the game that no one has ever heard of.
Exactly. Hey, I even looked on Amazon. There was one store that had it for $60.
Well, how much did you get it for at Toys R Us?
25.
Fantasy Flight Games has announced a reprint of the Call of Cthulhu living card game Asylum Pack, Kingsport Dreams, and it's coming later this year. According to Fantasy Flight, Kingsport Dreams reintroduces to the living card game environment this intriguing Asylum Pack, updated to the 60-card per pack format. The included cards have been updated to incorporate the most recent frequently asked questions. In addition, the text on a number of cards has been altered from its original printing to better fit into the current metagame, adjusting for game balance and rules clarity, making for an exciting and challenging gaming experience for both new players and veterans alike. Relive this classic pack from the Forgotten Lore cycle with improved features. Kingsport Dreams will be arriving in stores in the third quarter of this year. Fantasy Flight also announced the launch of their latest website, Fantasy Flight Gen Con Experience. They've created this site especially for you to keep track of their event information and help you prepare for Gen Con 2011. You can navigate their various offerings, learn how to purchase tickets, and stay up to date with all the latest news with Fantasy Flight's Gen Con Experience site. In addition, FFG is encouraging Gen Con attendees to sign up for their Gen Con Indie Twitter feed. In the next few weeks, you're going to see updates on their Gen Con Experience site as far as games that are going to be demoed at their booth, games that are going to debut at the show, seminars, special guests, and more.
Is it anything like the Wizarding World of Harry Potter experience at Universal Studios in Florida?
It's exactly like that. In fact, I think it's almost a complete reproduction of that.
You'll actually be devoured by Cthulhu.
We don't have Quidditch, we have Arkham Horror. If you've been wanting to try out the Pathfinder role-playing game but can't quite understand how it works, have no fear, because Paizo will be releasing a learn-to-play special set for you, the Pathfinder RPG Beginner Box. Paizo expects to release this Beginner Box in October. Now, the Pathfinder role-playing game Beginner Box is packed with everything you need to get started with the Pathfinder role-playing game, hence the name, an imaginative tabletop fantasy adventure game for 2 to 5 players. Scores of monsters, challenges, and advice give gamers the tools to create their own worlds and adventures, providing countless hours of gaming excitement. With streamlined rules and a focus on action-packed heroic adventure, this deluxe box set is the ideal introduction to the world of the Pathfinder RPG, and the best starting point for a lifetime of pulse-pounding adventure. Those are their words, not mine. So you can learn to build a hero ranging from a fighter to a wizard and many other character styles, and you can proceed on your adventures fighting goblins and dragons and so forth. So enter the world of Pathfinder, embracing your imagination as you play the role of your chosen hero.
What the hell is Pathfinder? Sorry.
You're just going to have to pick up the Beginner Box to find out.
Well, maybe I would.
It's a fairly popular RPG that's out there.
Huh. I don't know a lot about RPGs anymore.
It appears to be a pretty traditional high fantasy kind of game without probably hours upon hours of nitpicking that D&D has going for it.
I recently had an opportunity to playtest a new game to be released from VPG. The game is called...
Who's that?
Victory Point Games.
Who are they?
They're a game company. They make games. They sponsor the podcast.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Right. So the game's called For the Crown, and it's designed by Jeremy Leonard, right? In essence, it's a chess deck-building game. While this may sound odd, it's... in effect, a very strategic, deep game with lots of possibilities. It's a two-player game, of course, and the object is to capture the other player's sovereign units, which is basically capture the king and you win. If your opponent isn't paying attention and lets you move into position to take their king, well, they lose. The deck-building portion of the game is the intriguing part. There are action, order, and treasure cards, and many of these allow you to train pieces to place in your barracks. And yes, in this game, you each start with only your king on the board, and you have to train additional pieces, place them in your barracks, and then deploy them onto the battlefield, which is the board. The board itself is a standard chessboard, but the pieces are anything but standard. In addition to the normal pieces, the rook, the knight, the bishop, the queen, the pawn, there are other versions of these pieces that move in different ways, like the warlord. Can move one or two squares in any combination of directions. There's the monk, the acolyte, the griffin, and others for a total of 15 different types. And you start the game with 10 cards in your deck, 4 guards and 6 peons. The peons can provide you with 1 gold each card, as well as train a pawn to place in your barracks. The twist here is that when you use a card to train a piece, it's trashed. So even though that rook card will net you 3 gold to spend each turn, if you want to get a rook on the board, you have to trash the card. Each turn has several phases. During the order phase, you can move one of your pieces onto the board, or play an order card, or deploy a trained unit from your barracks to the board. They have to start in the back row, but a pawn or a foot unit can start in the first 2 rows, like in chess. Mm-hmm. The action phase allows you to play actions from your cards, like drawing additional cards, training units, stuff like that. And then the buy phase lets you total up the cards in your hand that have treasure amounts and purchase one of the cards from the stacks. If you want a queen, you'll have to purchase a consort card for 9 gold first.
And,
yes. And it'll take you some time to get that much, like it does in Dominion. Finally, you discard all your cards and draw 5 more, also like in Dominion. The combination of building a decent deck and playing a chess game with different movement patterns is challenging and fun. There's a lot of strategy to this game. It's a very deep game. There's good combos that can be attained, but these can also be countered by an observant player. You can't win the game by having the best deck, though. You can only win on the chessboard. And it's easy to forget that, and has cost me, well, pretty much every time I've played now.
Aha! So are you saying you're not an observant player?
I guess not, because I've gotten beat every time. Not that I'm any, great chess player, but, I do have some strategy capabilities. These pieces move in different ways, so it's really interesting. You got to keep track of what can move where. Then you got to build a good deck. It was actually really cool, and it was a lot of fun, and it's way shorter than playing a game of chess.
Any word on when we should be seeing this released?
I have no idea. Do you have any word on it? They haven't told me.
I'm just asking.
I'm playtesting.
I would think probably early June would be my guess. Late May, early June.
All right.
Maybe they'll release it at ConSimWorld. That's a possibility.
I'll go with that until I hear different.
Cool. I'll be on the lookout for it. And speaking of Victory Point Games, this is, the first show in quite a while that we will not have a review of a VPG game.
It's true.
We haven't gotten our hands on any recently, so we should have plenty more coming soon, so we'll get the streak going again.
Excellent.
I understand that you took some time out to speak with Scott Nicholson.
I did. It was pretty cool. I got to talk to Scott, and we talked about gaming at the library.
So you met him at the library and talked to him about gaming?
No, we talked about gaming at the library. The topic
right,
of...
Right, so you were at the library, and you were...
No, the fella with the Cleveland Indians.
Yeah, feller. Who's on first?
Wait, what's the guy's name on first base?
No, what's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
No, who's on first?
I don't know.
Third base. So on this edition of The Game Plan, Scott Nicholson from On Board Games joins Elliot for a discussion about gaming at the library.
Today I am talking with Dr. Scott Nicholson, Professor of Library Science at Syracuse University School of Information Studies. Scott is also the retired host of and creator of the popular Board Games with Scott video series, co-host of the On Board Games podcast with Donald Dennis and Eric Dewey, and an active gamer, traveler, writer, musician, and Morris dancer.
I think I need to pay you to show up and give that intro before every talk that I do.
There you go. Hey, it's great to have you on the show, Scott.
Well, thanks a lot. It'll be interesting to be here. It's always fun to explore topics of games with other folks that are used to talking about them.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we're here to do. Why don't you tell me a little bit about your current projects that you're working on?
Okay, so as you mentioned, I ended my Board Games with Scott series at the end of 2010. And really, I stepped back and recognized that the sort of stuff I wanted to focus on was not doing reviews of single games. That I was doing things now that I was trying to compare games, to look at design of games, to look at more concepts, to really actually tie in what I was doing in the board game media with my research as a professor. And to do that, you step back a lot further than looking at just individual games. And so the problem was I had done that for the last four or five episodes of Board Games with Scott, but the general world hadn't noticed, it seemed. It seemed I was getting just as many requests by publishers and by fans to review or do teaching videos on specific games. And I realized because the concept of Board Games with Scott had gotten so tightly tied in with taking one game and talking about it, that I was just not going to be able to unmarry those two in order to move it in a different direction. So I said, all right, I'm just going to shut that show down and then move on to some other projects where I can kind of reboot, if you will, can have new labels. And so that's what I'm doing now. I'm exploring a number of new directions and new spaces. So the first thing I started exploring was The Game Professor, a blog over on boardgameinfo.com. And the idea of that was to take on sort of bigger issues in the gaming space and explore them. I do plan to do video content there, but so far it's all been text content because that's just felt right with a more thoughtful exploration of topics. One of the challenges I found in the last few episodes of Board Games with Scott is that I couldn't find a good home for them on Board Game Geek. Board Game Geek was really good at providing single game entry points. But for things that don't cover a single game, that you could put it in the videos area and it would last for exactly a week and then would disappear. And at that point, no one would be able to find it easily. Now, they fixed that by adding a new blog feature. But that's something else that I have started. So I've also got a new blog on Board Game Geek called Get Off My Lawn. And the idea of that is there is something in a game, a very specific something in a game that will bother me to the point where I don't want to deal with that game anymore, or something I really would like to address. And so the point of Get Off My Lawn is to identify these issues that I'm having with games and talk about them. And my hope is that designers and publishers out there might at least briefly think before including that feature in a game that they are designing, just to realize one perspective of a grouchy old man, you know, when it comes to the board game world.
Now, how about an example? What's an example of something from Get Off My Lawn?
Well, my most recent one that I did was about the game Tick Call 2, and how it's naming Tick Call 2 after the game Tick Call. It's kind of like the comparison I made in the piece was that The Godfather 2 becoming a romantic comedy, that it's such a different feeling game than the original Tick Call, and the problems that caused is that first all the fans of Tick Call ran out and got Tick Call 2, many of them didn't like it and posted negative reviews. People who didn't like Tick Call, and I was one of those people, avoided Tick Call 2, but now are just starting to find out, hey, it's a different game. Maybe you should take a look. And I actually quite enjoyed it. And also, I really want to dissuade the publishing industry from getting into this habit of just taking game properties and adding numbers to the end of it. Because, you know, if you look at the NPDs for video games, and this is one thing I did in this piece, is I posted the March 2011 top games. You know, they were all sequels. They all games with numbers after the end of them in the video game industry.
Right.
And video game scholars comment about the board game space and say it's actually quite healthy because you don't have the high portion of retreading of the same licenses. You know, we may grouse about, oh, it's one more cube pushing game or one more area control game or things like that. But in the video game world, they're using the same mechanisms and the same spaces, intellectual property spaces. And in the board game world, they're at least combining different mechanisms and still going out in different directions. And so I wanted to try and dissuade people from thinking, yeah, I'm just going to make, you know, another game with a number at the end of it as a sequel. And so that was that article. So I wrote it, and I try to write them with a little bit of an old man crotchety sense of humor, but try to make a very, you know, with anytime you provide constructive criticism, it's best if it's specific and clear to say, this is the problem and here's why it's a problem. And so that's one thing I try to do, is I try to really be specific and say, this is the specific problem, rather than just say, oh, I hate this game. You know, try and say, here's the problem with it and here's why I have a problem with it, and something to think about. So that's the most recent one.
So if I kind of picture it as the old guy from the movie Up, the Pixar movie Up, as I read it, that would kind of be
I actually
feel.
I just came back from Disney, and one of the things I went to was the Muppets 3D, and watching Waldorf up there in the balcony, you know, that's I think that's a good visual of what you've got, are the old guys up there in the balcony poking fun at the things that are on stage.
Yes. You know, the Muppets 3D is one of my favorite things over there at Disney.
I actually have a lot of my personality that I bring forth in these various media outlets. Yeah, actually, a lot of it comes from the Muppets. And I've realized that as I watch the Muppets. I'm like, well, there's some Fozzie Bear, and there's some Kermit the Frog, and now I've got the old guys coming through. So I just need to get some Bork, Bork, Bork in there, and, you
bork,
know,
bork, bork.
And Animal is all throughout it. So there's a lot of the humor in the Muppets that actually comes through in the way that I present what I'm doing.
I'm sure I've heard some Gonzo in you from time to time.
I need more chickens. So that's what I'm up to from sort of a media perspective. Then my research world, so for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been doing a lot of research on libraries and gaming,
mm-hmm.
and wrote a book that came out last year called Everyone Plays at the Library, where I explored how a library can go from their mission and goals to having a gaming experience and not start with one problem I saw is a lot of libraries would start with a game and they'd have a hard time justifying why they were having these games in the library. So mm-hmm. instead, I thought about the wide world of gaming, and we're talking video, board, chess, ARGs, puzzles, you know, puzzle hunts, all sorts of gaming activities, and I created 5 archetypes to classify all gaming. And so the idea is that the library starts with their mission or goal. They pick one of these 5 archetypes, and then the book is organized around these 5 archetypes, and then you select the archetype that's best for your library goal, and then I've got recommendations for different specific games in different platforms and at different price levels based upon that archetype. And then you assess what you've done in the library back to your missions and goals so that when someone says, why do you have games in the library? You can say, get off my lawn. No, you can say, well, because it is helping us bring about this mission or this goal because you've assessed it back to that. So that's the whole premise of the book.
Oh, really?
What I've done, though, is I've stepped back and said, all right, what's the most interesting? And the most interesting thing to me came out of when libraries had programs that allowed their patrons to create games, game creation. That's when we saw some really interesting impacts. That's where we heard stories about taking kids who were in high school who really had no goals of going on to college, no career goals, having a game design program in the library, bringing in speakers from the gaming industry. And all of a sudden, you have these kids now that want to go to their local community college in English or writing or programming or art because they've gotten inspired because they got to make a game. That's pretty
yeah.
cool. That's now hitting on something that's pretty significant as far as a way that libraries could make a difference in their communities is by providing ways that kids get inspired, because part of what it does is it validates a kid's motivations. You know, one thing I've heard a lot is, oh, it must be so lucky to study games all the time and to be able to work with games in your work. And well, the reality is it makes games less fun. But part of what I'm doing is providing some tools to help more people to say, yeah, here's some aspects of gaming that actually are interesting career paths. Now, the reality is a lot of these kids will not end up working in the gaming industry.
Right.
But they're going into fields that have a lot of different job outputs. And more importantly, they're going to college. They have something that they are now saying, hey, I'm motivated to do this. And that's something that wasn't there before. So now a lot of my work and where my work is now really moving is into game design. And I'm actually looking more and more in board and card game design. I'm working on a book called The Board Game Design Cookbook. And the idea is to have each chapter about a board game mechanism, where I talk about the mechanism, talk about different ways it's implemented, and then provide the person with a little game that I'm designing using poker chips or cards that they could play to get an idea of what area control is, to how an auction could work, things like that. Because as I've done board game design programs, what I find is most people make board games that look either like chess or Monopoly.
Right.
Because that's what they know. And so I want to try and break them out of that by giving them some recipes, if you will. That's the model, the cookbook model. It's these recipes that you could use to explore a topic. And so now I'm applying that in a school setting. So my idea is to help teachers and librarians, after they've taught some topic in class, to be able to help them facilitate a tabletop game design experience where we will map these different recipes to different curricular goals. So, and that's what school librarians do. And so I'm working with some school librarians. The idea is that, okay, you've just taught, these sorts of physics. Well, here are 3 different board game mechanisms that might be appropriate. Split the class up into group, give each group 1 mechanism and say, make a game applying just what we've learned using this mechanism to explore it. And then everyone play everyone else's games. And that's something you could do in just a few hours, in 2 to 3 days of class time. You could have workable prototypes of games that explore what you've just learned in class in a different way. And research shows that if you create a game about something, uh-huh. it goes into your long-term processing and long-term memory much better than most other forms of pedagogical exploration.
Oh, yeah. You know, do you think there could be anything in existence like a blank board game design kit?
Well, actually, I've been talking with one of the publishers about this idea, and they actually have tossed that idea around before.
Oh, really?
As making a kit with all you'd need to make a board game. You know, there was a print your own monopoly for a mm-hmm. while. They kind of stopped. They didn't pursue it. And I've talked to them a little bit more to say, well, you know, if we do something in line with this book where you've got the toolkit to understand the different mechanisms and now some parts. But the joy of doing this and one of the nice things about doing this is, you know, when you're dealing with a classroom, most of our classrooms in the U.S., the teachers have very, very small budgets.
Right.
To do anything. They usually have to pay for stuff out of their own pocket. And so the cheaper I can make this entry point, you know, poster boards, index cards, dice, M&Ms,
right.
you know, the more likely it is that people are going to be able to use it. Because even if you have a kit that might be $19.95, you can't buy that for 30 students. And that's a very expensive proposition.
Yeah.
But if you have them in groups, you know, you can buy a stack of poster board. You can have them bring magazines from home. You can, you know, you can really source a lot of stuff to make games out of. Because with these projects, the goal is not to make this fantastic game at the end. The goal is the process of making the game. That's where the learning happens. And one of the design restrictions on all these games is that you can't ask questions. These are not going to be trivia games. The idea is that you have to find the game in the topic of the material you've just explored, and that's what you're going to explore as you play the game.
You know, I think it would also add a lot to improving social skills and teamwork abilities,
mm-hmm.
too.
Right. There's a lot of interesting things that'll happen when you get people stopping staring at screens and actually looking at other people as they're engaging with each other to create these games. And I call these games the sort of games we like to play, these face-to-face games, because you're looking at other people's faces and engaging with them that way as compared to a face-to-screen
yes.
experience, where you lose a lot of that social
yes,
engagement.
Very much so.
So there's my extremely long answer to your question of, what are you up to?
Last November 13th was National Gaming Day at the library.
Right. Uh-huh.
And that took place at over 1,800 libraries in the U.S. and some abroad. Can you tell me something about how National Gaming Day itself came about?
Well, it started, this was the third one. And so the American Library Association is the largest organization that supports libraries. And so they have two conferences a year, and the conferences draw tens of thousands of librarians together. One of the things I started in this organization was the Games and Gaming Members Initiative Group, which was a way for librarians to come together who are interested in gaming. Mm-hmm. And we started talking about how could we really raise people's awareness of gaming in libraries. How could we get more libraries to do a gaming program? If we could get libraries to try one, maybe that would make a difference. And so it started with the idea of getting as many libraries to play the same game at the same time and try and get that going as a Guinness record.
Uh-huh.
And so my original proposal was actually Ticket to Ride, was to say, what if we got as many libraries to play a game of Ticket to Ride at the exact same time? Could that count as a Guinness record? So we applied to Guinness, talked to them. They said, well, in order for us to do that, you would have to have either a Guinness representative or a town official at each and every site to verify this was going on. They said, we really don't have a category for that. If it was some sort of a competition or a tournament, then we could look into it. So we said, all right, that's not going to work. And then Hasbro came into the picture, and Hasbro became willing to send a copy of the same game to every library in the U.S.
Wow.
And they pay for it all. And so we said, all right, well, we're going to work with this then. So because part of what can get the attention of libraries, especially in a tough economy, is free stuff.
Uh-huh.
So we built this whole package around these free games that were being sent out. So the libraries would receive these free games along with this thing saying, hey, we'd really like it if you would do a gaming program on this day. And if you would come back and tell us what you did so we can collect data on it.
Mm-hmm.
So Hasbro got involved. North Star Games got involved with Wits and Wagers. They've been giving out now a few thousand games each day to the first few thousand libraries for each of the National Gaming Days that register.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been getting 25 to 30,000 people in libraries on the same day each year now for the last few years. And it's really a chance to raise awareness. And so we're taking now, I think, some of the things we've done are national video game tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
Where using the ability to hook up via the works to do Mario Kart tournaments, and to do Rock Band tournaments where people pick a song and then they register their scores. Eli Nyberger, who is in Michigan, does great software to help administrate these national tournaments on National Gaming Day, and software designed for libraries to help them run their own gaming programs. So I think it's really had an impact on helping raise awareness of library gaming and helping libraries to try gaming programs. And so it's going to continue on into the future, and hopefully will continue to grow.
This past year, my local library wasn't involved. Now, what could I do to help get them involved in this coming year on November 12th?
Well, one of the things that I encourage folks to do is to go and talk to your librarian to say, hey, do you know about National Gaming Day? And point them to some of the information that's out there and tell them, most importantly, you could tell them, I'm willing to help. That's the number one thing, because a lot of libraries may be nervous to get involved with gaming. One of the reasons is when people think of gaming and gamers, they tend to think of video games. But the reality is gaming can be a huge variety of things. It could be anything from a chess tournament to Scrabble games to just have your game club show up and run a board game demo to having people do game creation where they get together and make games to doing a big puzzle hunt that runs all over the library. There's a huge variety of gaming activities. But what most importantly you could do is go to the library and said, I'd love to see you guys participate in National Gaming Day, and I'm willing to help, and I have friends who can come too. You know, the idea of we have this gaming group and we can all show up and we'll be there. We can bring our own games. We're willing to help teach them. You just provide the space and help provide the marketing, and we'll go from there. What will happen is, as we get a little closer, there'll be an opportunity for the library to sign up with the American Library Association and say, yes, we're going to participate. That will qualify them to get more free games. Because we have more and more publishers that are going to give away so many thousand copies of games, but only to the first batch of libraries that sign up. And so that can be an important thing to do. That would be what we would encourage if you wanted to get going. I've made some videos in the past, and again, if one of the big projects that I'm working toward comes through, you'll see another big packet going out, trying to reach out to folks, to gamers, to say, hey, go to your library, tell them you want to do this, and tell them you're willing to help, because that's going to be the best way to get it going.
Excellent. Well, I'm hoping we can help pass that word along to a few people.
There's actually a podcast if you want to learn a little bit about the perspective of gaming and libraries. There's the Gaming and Libraries podcast, which actually Don Dennis is putting together the next episode of, because he's one of the co-hosts on Board Games, and he actually works in a library doing the gaming for four different libraries, doing gaming programs. And so he's actually involved with this as well.
Oh, excellent. And where would we find that podcast?
That podcast is over at gamesandlibraries.org.
So a lot of game design in the future too?
Yeah, so I've got, you know, I've got one game which is currently with a publisher, and it's working its way through. Sadly, I can't talk about that. And then I'm working on several more. The thing I'm trying to bring about really are more game experiences. I'm focusing on the experience between the players. I'm taking a lot of direction from video games, actually. Mm-hmm. So I've been looking a lot at how do I create games that take some of the interactive components of video games and bring them into board games, because I'm trying to create more game experiences that you could put down in a library setting and lure people away from the video games, that you could get a video gamer interested in the board game space if you have a game that has some video game components. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing a lot of games. Actually, all the designs I'm working on right now are all lifetime games. Games where there are not turns, but you're all playing at the same time. Because I find that tends to be a more attractive experience for people that play video games, and it's something they're comfortable doing, is everyone's engaged with the game at the same time. The challenge with making a lifetime game is it has to be simple.
Yes.
It can't be too complex. And that's been a fun design constraint to work with. How do you take a game, you build it up, and then make this crunchy Euro and say, now how do I pull out enough of this so that I could play it with people and in lifetime? And it would still work. So it's been fun to explore those game spaces.
Well, I can imagine you have to struggle a lot with it breaking off into chaos.
Mm-hmm. And that's really what you're doing, is you're writing this line of chaos, which actually, if you think about, you know, any lifetime video game, if you go pop on to Xbox Live and play Halo against other people, that's really organized chaos. I mean, that's, you know, you're just on the line of chaos there. And so multiplayer lifetime video games are chaotic experiences, and trying to capture some of that in a board game. Now, what's funny is I will present that to people who are used to having time to think about things. And, you know, lifetime game activities make you stupid. That's You really don't have the time to think about, oh, I wonder if I should balance my risk. Oh, crap! You know, and you and so I find some people really react strongly to that, and they don't like the fact that, you know, they're known as this really strong strategic player, and all of a sudden they're put in a situation where they got to go off the seat of their pants. But that's really the experiences I'm looking to explore now. And the other thing is, then they're fast paced, they're over quickly. You know, you can play several rounds and enjoy spending time with each other when you're engaged in that kind of thing.
Right. Oh, actually, that sounds pretty good. I look forward to that. Well, it definitely sounds like you're keeping yourself busy. That's for sure. We have covered quite a bit.
GameLab.syr.edu should keep you up with what I'm up to.
Excellent. Well, Scott, thanks a lot for being on the show.
Okay.
And it was great talking.
Well, have fun out there, and make sure and appreciate the people you're playing with. Recognize that they're more than just someone pushing cubes back at you.
Thanks, Scott. Well, now back to the show.
I have to say, Scott Nicholson sounds like he's a pretty nice guy.
Hello? Is there anyone out there? Oh. Help! Help! Anybody help!
Hey, Elliot, what's going on?
So cold. So very cold.
What are you talking about? It's got to be 150 degrees in the Villa Park Studios. What are you wearing that parka and those gloves for?
It freezes. It burns.
What?
Expedition.
Hey, turn off this wind machine here, and what is this, fake snow? What is this? Are these soap flakes? What is this?
Dandruff.
Oh, what is all this for?
Haven't you heard about the new Victory Point Games release, Disaster on K2?
Oh, now I get it.
From designer Tom Beck.
Oh, I'm still frozen.
From designer Tom Decker comes the next challenge, climbing and conquering to survive the disaster on K2. As an internationally renowned expedition leader, you're anxious to gain prestige by leading a group of high-profile climbers from your country to the top of the most difficult peak in the world, K2. While some of the climbers have been selected for their climbing abilities, others have been assigned to your team for various political reasons. Certainly, if you can accomplish this feat, your name will go down as one of the greatest expedition leaders of all time, and your fame and fortune will be assured. Play solitaire or compete against another player to lead your climbers to the summit of K2 and back down safely, or take on the challenge of climbing both Everest and K2 in the campaign game by adding VPG's Disaster on Everest. You know, is it K2 or is it K-squared? I can never get that straight.
It's K2. Nobody tackles K3. It's 17 miles high!
And now it's time for the Gaming Gang's game review. Try saying that 10 times fast.
I'm not going to try.
Okay, the first game I'm going to talk about is, finally, Mansions of Madness. From Fantasy Flight Games.
That sounds familiar.
Yes, it should. We've talked about it quite often. Never done a review, though. Designed by Corey Konitska. Published in 2011 for 2 to 5 players. Ages 13 and up. Takes 2 hours to play or more.
Focus on or more.
So, am I biased? I'm a huge H.P. Lovecraft fan.
Yes. Biased.
And a new Mythos-based board game from FFG really got me going. Arkham Horror is one of my favorite games. Only the length of the game prevents me from getting it to the table more often. Well, Mansions of Madness attempts to take a step further in the realm of board games. It tries to tell a story. Even go so far as to add a cinematic feel to the game. There's characters, they have backstories, there's an introduction to each scenario. There are clues that can be found to further the story. Every few turns, an event occurs, letting everyone know that game time is limited, so you'd better get yourself moving or it'll go on without you. Every attack you make or receive is unique and has descriptive text, like, you blow the top of its head off, or you slip and fall, missing completely. The board itself is modular, and it's built differently for each scenario. There are different sets of clues, cards, monsters, everything for each scenario.
You may find a puzzle that you need to solve, like picking a lock or rewiring an outlet to get the lights back on. 8 different investigators to choose from. And one interesting point of note is that these are the same characters we've come to know from Arkham Horror. They have character cards and detailed plastic miniatures that are unpainted to go with them. Another note, since FFG now offers a complete line of painted Arkham Horror figures, you can buy all the ones you need if you prefer them painted. Or you can ask your buddy Jeff to paint them for you.
Who? What? Huh?
There are several character trait cards to choose from, letting you fine-tune your person and possibly giving you different starting equipment. Do you want to take your dog Duke with you? Or keep your guitar handy?
I knew that was coming. I knew that was coming. Ashcan Pete.
That's right.
So there is a figure for Ashcan Pete?
Yes, there is.
Is there a dog with
it? And he has a guitar and a dog.
There you go. So the guitar is sitting by his side and he's got the dog strapped to his back?
That's exactly how it works. You can actually use the guitar as a weapon, too.
It's like El Kabong.
Kabong!
Hold on there a minute there, Bob-a-loo-wee. I'll do the thinning around here.
There's also 24 different monster figures. Those are also unpainted. Each with a base that allows you to insert their stat tokens in them. So you can see their damage and other stats. And in effect, you can have different versions of the same monster figure. So you can have Super Zombie or Zombie 2 or whatever. You just switch out the bases. Meanwhile, there are scary things afoot. Monsters can appear. Horrible creatures that will slowly drive you insane. You need to keep it together despite your broken arm and your claustrophobia. You didn't have these problems when you came in here. There's a keeper, a controller of the evil that is trying to stop your band of investigators. The keeper is not a GM, as in a role-playing game. The keeper is another player, actively working against your team to stop you. The object of the game is different, depending on the scenario that you're playing. There's 5 scenarios, and each one has 3 possible objectives, giving you 15 different possible adventures you can challenge. Most of the game time is spent tracking down the clues to discover what your objective is. Then it becomes a race against the clock to see if you can finish the game and win before the keeper can stop you. The rules themselves are actually not bad. There are separate books for the keeper and the players, which enables you to share the setup time. And this is good, because the setup time is extensive. Just sorting out the cards you will need will take 20 minutes, depending on how organized you can be. In reality, I find it's better to have the game set up before the players even get there, if you're the keeper, that is.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And there's some fuzziness and jumble to the rules in places, so it helps to get the FAQs from Fantasy Flight's website. And you can expect to flip back and forth in the rules for your first few games. Now, one thing to note, setup is important because if you put a wrong card in a wrong place, you're going to screw the game up. So,
nice.
If there's specific cards that go in a specific pile in specific rooms.
Are you mentioning this because you did that?
No, I haven't had it happen, but I could see where it could easily happen.
Okay.
There's a lot to describe in this game, so I'm not going to rehash all the rules. Instead, let's just go through a typical turn to give you a feel for it. It's the player's turn. Ashcan Pete says he wants to go first since he has the shotgun.
I want to go first because I got the shotgun!
He fires at the maniac in front of him and manages to deal 4 points of damage.
Get him, Duke!
He's injured. But not dead. Pete decides to stay put and hope he can avoid getting killed.
I think I'll stay here and I sure hope I don't get killed!
Meanwhile, Sister Mary manages to finish the wiring puzzle, and the lights come on in the bedroom.
My goodness, I see the lights are on finally!
She finds a torn journal entry.
Ooh, what's this? It's a clue!
Zoinks! And indicate that there's something sinister happening in the basement.
There must be something going on in the basement!
Now she goes back in the hallway.
Oh, I think I'll go in the hall first.
Meanwhile, Joe Diamond moves into the operating room where Ashcan Pete is fighting off the maniac.
What's going on in here, Pete? Oh, goodness, that looks like a maniac.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ringo Starr as Joe Diamond.
Hey. Hey, Ashcan Pete, what's going on?
Unfortunately for him, the sight drives him a little mad.
You're 16, you're beautiful, and you're mine.
The keeper lets him know that he has developed a fear of enclosed places.
Joe better end his turns in a big room or he's going to have a problem.
I best Joe stay laughs. In this big room.
A little shakily and fires.
Bang.
Sadly for him, he misses.
Damn.
The keeper now gathers his new threat tokens and plays a card. A cultist appears next to Sister Mary, who's all alone.
Oh, goodness, who's this?
She's startled, but manages to hold it together and passes her horror check. The cultist manages to get a lock of Sister Mary's hair and moves out of the room to some nefarious purpose. The keeper plays another card and draws new mythos and trauma cards with an evil smile on his face. He has the maniac attack poor Pete, but Pete is quicker. The maniac falls and is stunned. He'll be easy picking for the player's next turn.
Take a little of that with you, you crazy maniac!
So meanwhile, the keeper adds a time token to the event card. Next turn, he'll turn over another event. Little do the players realize that they now only have 3 turns left to win the game, and they don't even know what they need to do to get out alive yet.
Dun dun!
If only they had listened to the clues and thought to go into the basement a few turns ago, or helped Sister Mary solve the puzzle, they might have a better chance. Joe Diamond's about to die on his next turn and doesn't realize that either. Right now, things are looking up for the bad guys. The keeper looks up, smiles, and says, "Okay, your turn." I think this game is excellent. I own the game, so I'm usually the keeper, and this is probably the situation for most owners. The keeper does their best to stop the players from succeeding and has many options available to them within limits. Each scenario tells the keeper which keeper action cards are available to them to use against the players, so you won't be summoning a Shuggoth every game. There's mythos cards and trauma cards that the keeper can get, which you can use to whittle away the player's sanity, health, give them phobias, even kill them. It's a lot of fun playing the keeper, but the keeper needs to be fair as well. The keeper can make or break the gaming experience for the players, similar to a GM, so you need to keep that in mind while you play. For example, if you concentrate on attacking one particular player, it would probably ruin the experience for them. You need to balance your attacks and share the misery, at least if you want to keep them coming back to play again. The game can also be a lot of fun for the players. The keeper has rules so they can be defeated. I've both won and lost games as the keeper, and it's actually cool sometimes to see the players' jubilation at the end when they overcome the evil at the last minute and win the game.
Hooray!
Hooray! The characters have special cards and traits that are available only to that specific character, so it helps the players tune the experience to suit their own tastes. Additionally, in most cases, if a character is killed, the player simply selects a new one and comes back into the mansion. Unless there's none left. Then they're out of luck. One final note, I recently tested using room descriptions for every room in the scenario to try to add to the story-like flavor of the game, kind of like a GM would do.
Sure.
And they really enjoyed it a lot and said that it enhanced the experience for them. So I'm just passing that along to anyone who's interested in trying it. Again, the game is excellent as it is, and I'm hoping for expansion soon, as I'm already looking forward to some fresh scenarios.
Could it be Origins or Gen Con?
I would think sooner would be better rather than later, because people are already demanding expansions.
Well, people can demand all they want.
You know, to tell you the truth, 5 stories isn't really a lot.
Right.
I agree.
They have
different endings, but still.
They're all very similar.
Mm-hmm. Excellent game.
Very cool. And those of you out there with a friend named Jeff, get him started painting your figures.
Yes.
From talking about a game that has aspects of role-playing, we're going to move along to a product that is a role-playing game supplement or source book. As we continue to grow and as we get our sea legs under us, Elliot and I are going to continue to push the envelope and cover not only just board games, but also delve into the genres of miniatures and RPGs. This really isn't as earth-shattering as it may sound, simply because Elliot and I not only cut our teeth on the old Avalon Hill, SPI, SJG, Task Force, along with tons of other companies, board games that were stocked on the shelves in our high school days, but we were also big-time role-playing fools, too.
big time.
I can say, oh yeah, we were. I can say with complete honesty, between the two of us, we've either owned or played at least 100 different role-playing systems over the years. Now, any game master worth their salt can tell you that they pick up new RPG rules, not always necessarily to look to run a new system, but in order to crib, I hate to say steal, a new thought or wrinkle in which to include in their current favorite game setting. And woe to the role player whose ref isn't looking for new ways to make their game more involving or more enjoyable. So our first foray into reviewing a new role-playing product is from our good friends at AEG, and I'll be the first to say it is a doozy. Emerald Empire, the 4th edition, is a source book for AEG's immensely popular Legend of the Five Rings RPG, and it's thoroughly worth picking up. It's 320 pages, and the interesting thing is it is the 4th edition, but a full 25% of the material is brand new for this edition. It's worth picking up not only for those who are running or playing an L5R system, but even for anyone who's interested in an ancient Japan Bushido-type setting. Of course, naturally, the book caters to L5R, but there's enough nuggets of information to make the book valuable to just about any GM's library. I'm going to provide full disclosure and point out that I do not own, nor have I read, the base L5R RPG system or any of their previous products in the line. Now, the basis for L5R is all in all pretty new to me, outside of playing a few games of the collectible card game when it first came out. By pointing this out, I'm sure there's going to be a few listeners out there who are going to be scratching their heads as to why I'm even reviewing this, and better yet, giving it such a high score. The answer is pretty simple. Having invested all the years I have into making sure my friends who were involved in a role-playing game that I was running had an awesome time, I can tell you a piece of crap sourcebook from a legitimate tome in my sleep. Now, I can't tell you why you'd want to play specifically as a member of the Crab or Scorpion or Lion clans, but after reading Emerald Empire cover to cover, I can tell you I'd really be interested in finding out. And that's what RPG sourcebooks do. They engage the imagination and they make you want to run out and put a game together ASAP. It's me wanting to kick myself because I don't have the core L5R book. And I went to one of the best sources of used role-playing game rules here in the Phoenix area called Bookman's. And I went over the past couple of weekends, but to no avail. So I can't sit back and tell you all there is about the game system itself. Yet while reading through the source book, my interest is piqued enough in getting down and dirty with the game itself that I did drive over a couple of times to see if they had a copy of the rules. I can take the usual flat, dry review presentation, break things down chapter by chapter, but I don't think that would do much of a service here, since those who are specifically looking for information about the book are no doubt going to find exactly what they're looking for elsewhere. Plus, those of you who are regular visitors to the Gaming Gang or listeners to the show already know that we don't necessarily operate in the distance antiseptic way that a lot of other gaming podcasts or websites do. We just kind of lay it out there and give you the good and the bad, so you can kind of take it from there. If you're a referee or GM of L5R, sorry, I'm not real big on whatever tag a system wants to put on the guy or gal who's running the show, you're going to find everything contained in the book pretty essential. And I will point out that I've been told by people who have been playing the game for some time that this isn't just a rehash of what was available in the last edition. As I mentioned, about 25% of this is all brand new, and it is lavishly illustrated throughout. So even if you took into account all the illustrations, I would take a guess at probably 10 to 15% of everything print-wise is brand new overall. There's chapters on customs and politics, religion, and social structure that are going to be essential for those who play or run L5R. Immersion is the name of the game in role-playing, and these chapters provide pretty minute detail in the daily lives of not only the players, but the nameless parades of NPCs that they'll no doubt encounter in their adventures. This background isn't something that needs to be memorized verbatim by the referee or the players, but it's something that they can draw upon to help fill in the blanks or provide backstory when it's needed. Also, players would be best served to have a copy to pass around between game sessions to read up on everything to get a better understanding of the do's and don'ts in the game setting. I've always lucked out during my 20 plus years of running Call of Cthulhu that the setting wasn't too far removed from our everyday history. I didn't need tons of background info in order to immerse my players into the game because it was still our everyday world, even if it was a bit skewed by the old ones. And that's a major strength of that system. And that's why I think Emerald Empire is such a great source book. Here you have a setting, granted one in which that still draws from traditional Asian mythos for the most part, but still includes more than 20 years of tweaks and refinements to present a thoroughly original stage for role players to take to tell their tales. In the end, the only real issue I have with Emerald Empire 4th Edition is, scattered throughout the book, are story nuggets. This isn't a GM's guide by any stretch, and I think the value of presenting kernels for budding GMs as far as adventures is going to be completely lost. Why would I run an adventure based upon a tale my players already know the end of? I need my players to read this book to make my life easier, not necessarily to come up with ideas for little adventure nuggets. Overall, if you're even thinking of running a Legend of the Five Rings role-playing game or just into running an RPG set in pre-industrial Asia, the 4th edition of Emerald Empire is certainly worth a look. And if you're already well entangled in the intrigue of the game, you'd still be best served to pick up a copy.
You know, I gotta admit, this is a beautiful book. The hardcover, all the artwork, it's full color. And yeah, I haven't finished reading it yet, but just what I'm going through gives me the urge to actually get a chance to play this game. So I'm going to look in now for a way to play the role-playing game. I don't want to run it, of course.
Well, sure.
I'd love to be able to play it. So.
You know, I'm sure we'll probably get a chance to maybe get into an introductory game or something at Gen Con.
Yeah, that would be cool. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
And it's funny, too, because reading through the book, and of course there's references to things that are in the actual rule book that you can kind of be fairly clueless if you don't know anything about Legend of the Five Rings, the RPG. Mm-hmm. But still, even with that in mind, reading through it was like, wow, hey, oh, that's very cool. And there's so much information there because, especially games that are set in that kind of samurai setting, there are so many different cultural differences between East and West, just in reality, historically. And I think that's part of the fascination where there's, in this game, there's such a cultural cast and everybody has their place. And it talks about different like intrigue at court and the emperor and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. It really is an interesting book to read, even never having played L5R.
Mm-hmm. I have to agree. Finally, I'm going to talk about Resident Evil Alliance.
Oh, thank goodness.
Published by Bandai. Designed by Jack L. Hung. Just came out, actually. For 1 to 4 players, ages 13 and up. Takes about 45 minutes, I'd say, in reality. Yeah, about an hour, depending on what rules you're using.
Yeah, right.
Now, I've never played the original version of the Resident Evil deck-building game.
Which just came out a few months ago.
Yeah. Luckily, the first expansion, Alliance, which is the one I'm talking about, can be played standalone, so you don't need the original in order to play it. Similar to how Dominion and Intrigue was.
Mm-hmm.
The game is based upon the video game series from Capcom and not the movies. I'm a fan of the video games, but not like my children who already know all of the characters and monsters. The rulebook is similar to the rulebooks in all of the video games, which for me, I found the small Times New Roman font on top of a blood-splattered background really hard to read in both the video and the board game. And I wish the cardstock was a little better. The cards that I have are already starting to bend. This deck-building game features character cards, which you play as one of your favorite characters from the video game. Your character card has their health and the special abilities they get when they level up. You can actually level your characters twice during the course of a game as you kill more monsters.
Are you in Raccoon City?
Right now, no, I'm in Villa Park. No, there is a mansion pile. So you're exploring a mansion, and there's a lot of mansions going on.
Because I always thought that was the stupidest thing in Resident Evil games.
What, raccoons?
Raccoon City. It was like, what? That's right, because I live in Grizzly Bearville.
I live in Beaverland.
Hey.
There's action cards. There are piles of action cards that you can buy. Most feature extra actions, buys, ammo, cards, or gold. Additionally, each one has a special action that you can use. There's weapon cards. All of your favorite weapons are here and are available for purchase. The interesting twist here is that each stack of weapons cards also includes a special version of the card that you can buy when it finally comes up on top of the pile. And each weapon card lists the ammo requirements to use it and the damage it can do. There's ammo cards. Every weapon needs ammo, except, of course, the combat knife. You use ammo cards to load up your weapons. They also provide the cash you need to buy better gear. So it lists amount of cash and amount of ammo right on one card.
So you're exploring a mansion, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Is there like an ammunition store in the mansion?
Yes. Right there. Right before you go in, there's a booth. It's like those fireworks stands you see over in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Ammo. Get your 45 caliber ammo.
Yeah, I just think it's kind of strange where it's like, well, there's ammo cards and you collect the ammo cards to buy ammo. And I'm like, from where? You're in a mansion.
They have item cards. So there's green and red herbs to help you heal if you need it, which you might. There's bonus cards. Earn extra turns or extra decorations, which are victory points. New to the game in this expansion. There are event cards. There are 5 event cards in Alliance that go into the mansion deck. Some are good, some are bad. And then there's finally the infected cards. These are the monsters that make up the bulk of the mansion deck. You must explore the mansion killing infected to earn decorations, which again are victory points, and win the game.
Now they're infected with a bad case of herpes, isn't that what it
exactly.
is? Exactly. Isn't that the story?
No, it's HPV.
HPV, you said?
Human papillomavirus?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm still telling you, man. I think it's super herpes.
Super herpes. The game can be played in 3 modes, either story mode, mercenary mode, or versus mode.
So, isn't there a fourth mode?
What's fourth mode?
Let's get this game over with already.
Story mode is the standard game where you play until one of you faces and defeats Albert Wesker. Now, mercenary mode puts a time limit on the game, giving you only 15 turns to get as many victory points as you can. And this version can be played in teams and is definitely faster than story mode. You can earn extra turns by getting bonus cards, which you only use in this particular mode. Versus mode pits the players against each other, and the last one alive wins. The action cards have an array of abilities, plus one card, plus one action, so on. Some of them seem a little overpowered to me. I watched one player use a sequence of cards to purchase and draw a huge amount of cards into their hand every turn. Then they were able to use their character's ability, Jack Krauser, to gain X times 10 damage, where X is the number of cards in their hand. So they were easily doing 100 to 150 points of damage per turn and just ran away with the game. An interesting addition in this expansion is the concept of partners. You can play the game with 2 characters, one main and one secondary. Your partner can be given a weapon and either sent in to explore the mansion first or second. If they're killed, they're gone for good. It's a nice option to the game, and so I usually include them. Each turn, you perform actions, buy a card, and explore the mansion.
Is that supposed to be frightening?
Boo.
Boo. I have herpes.
Boo. I'm going to scare herpes. If you face a monster but can't beat it with your combination of weapons and ammo, you take the damage.
Beat it.
You take the damage listed on the infected card and it goes to the bottom of the deck, waiting to strike again. The rules say that story mode should only take an hour, but in my experience it's been 2 each time. Eventually the players get so many plus action, plus cards, plus buy cards in their hands that it takes somebody forever to finish their turn. We've tried several modifications to shorten the game.
The one we settled on now.
Such as not playing it.
Last, it went really short after that.
The one that was very quick.
The one we settled on is shuffling Wesker into the bottom 10 cards of the deck so he can't prematurely end the game. Once he,
that sounds like a personal private problem there.
Once he does pop up, he stays face up until somebody beats him. Now in the regular game, if you don't beat him, and he's the one who takes, it takes the most damage to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
In the game, if you don't beat him, he goes to the bottom of the deck and you got to wait for him to come all the way up through the deck again to face him again.
Oh my gosh. Right.
We're playing, once he shows up, he stays on top until somebody can beat him. So that did shorten the game somewhat, and we had the problem of what to do with the other infected that we couldn't beat. But we just followed the rules and placed them on the bottom of the deck. And that actually worked because one of the weapons forces you to draw from the bottom of the mansion deck instead of the top. So we still got to go to both sides of the deck. So that all worked out. I will admit there are some exciting moments. If you're a fan of the games, then you'll really like this board game. It is thematic, and you have to cope with the tension of which monster will come up when you enter the mansion. If you're not a fan of the games, well, I don't know. It takes a long time, and there's some goofy rules in it. Some of the cards are a little unbalanced.
I had heard that the first edition of the game, the Resident Evil deck-building game, was terrible. But of course, I didn't play it, but I heard from quite a few people that it was really, really bad. Would you say that this is not a really, really bad game, just kind of an average game?
I believe, from my playing and what I've read about the original game, that there have been improvements made to this version of it. Especially things like the, you know, adding partners and things like that. So they have taking into consideration some of the negative aspects that they heard about from the original game and improved upon mm-hmm. them in this game. For me, though, it still lasted a little too long.
I would take a guess there's probably other games in your collection that you would be bringing to the table much quicker than you would Resident Evil Alliance.
Right. But like I said, the kids love it. So, you know, if you're playing with teenagers or those that, you know, are big fans of it, hey, they'll have a blast. And you know, it is okay.
But those of us who are crotchety gaming curmudgeons.
Right. Wouldn't enjoy it at all.
I didn't say we'd enjoy it at all, but it may not have that same kind of luster for us.
Yes.
Good deal. Good deal. I'm glad to hear that Bandai actually did address some of the concerns that many of the players of the first Resident Evil game had. So that's nice to hear. Mm-hmm. I believe that should be just about it for this week's show. What do you think?
I think you're right.
Was there anything else, Elliot?
Oh, wait. Yeah, there was something more. Wait, it was really important. I forget it. I'll just wait till next show.
You've been listening to the Gaming Gang Podcast with Jeff McAleer and Elliot Miller. If you'd like to know more about the topics or games we discussed in this episode, please visit our website at www.thegaminggang.com. If you would like to have your opinion heard or have a gaming issue you'd like us to discuss on a future podcast, you can visit the Gaming Gang Guild on BoardGameGeek or call us at 480-779-7365 and leave a message. If you enjoyed listening to our podcast, please rate us on iTunes. Some of the games discussed on our show were provided to the Gaming Gang in the form of review copies. On behalf of everyone here at the Gaming Gang, thanks for listening.